Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. The most authoritative study ever done on the impact of Sesame Street was released in June, and it found, it was done by researchers at the University of Maryland, that the most famous show on public TV has delivered lasting educational benefits to millions of American children, benefits as powerful as the ones that children can get from going to preschool. We're going to be talking about the power of Sesame Street this hour of the program, and also the limitations of learning things on television. Our guest has a very, very interesting series of research projects going on, and his educational study is also very interesting, what he teaches. Professor Travis Wright is Assistant Professor of Multicultural Education, Teacher Education, and Childhood Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's an educational researcher, he's a psychologist, and was a dedicated Sesame Street viewer during his own childhood in the 1970s. He is well acquainted, he says, with the show's power to influence children, but he's also concerned that TV and electronic media more generally can be leveraged to address income and racial gaps in children's school readiness. He says, well, perhaps they can, but he does have a perspective on why this program has had such a positive impact on young viewers. And I'm sure that you have your own stories that you watch Sesame Street, or your children or grandchildren watch Sesame Street. What is it that has made this show receive such universal acclaim for all of these years? Since 1969, it went on the air. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Professor Travis Wright, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. So you watched the show when you were a young guy, huh?
I loved it every day.
Why did you love it as a child?
I think I liked its predictability. My grandmother, I stayed with my grandmother, and every day she would make my lunch, and I would sit down in front of the TV, and I would watch Sesame Street before my nap, and I was the firstborn, and I lived out in the middle of the country, and the Sesame Street characters were my friends. I saw them every day. I counted on them. They talked to me about things that mattered. They presented things in a way that was of interest to me. They were my friends, and they took me seriously, and they showed up every day, and they helped me feel smarter. And it was just a great touchstone in my childhood.
You have written about how this show is really developmentally appropriate, that it's obvious that people know what happens to development in those early childhood years work on the show, that they're the people who are behind the show as well as the people who entertain us.
Absolutely. Sesame Street has a whole network of people who work to develop the show in a way that is developmentally appropriate. They also develop materials that help teachers and parents extend the learning that is happening on the show. I think Sesame Street understands as well as anyone that that they are a resource and that they can help enhance knowledge, but that they're no substitute for parents and schools, which are children's first teachers. And so they make sure that what they're talking about on the air is of relevance to the things that are happening at home, and then they support parents and schools in using that content in their own spaces.
Mm-hmm. What has the show done, if anything, to bridge the achievement gap?
Well, in many ways, when children have access to television, it's a democratizing influence. So if any child, regardless of your income or your race or your family's socioeconomic status, can tune in and watch the show if they have access to television. And so in that way, Sesame Street is a more democratic. It allows people to watch the show that might not have access to other forms of elite education. And so kids of all backgrounds can watch Sesame Street. And so many of the inequalities that are present in the actual school systems are sort of dismantled by Sesame Street because it has much more universal access. But I think that we need to be very cautious about looking at media and television as the cure-all. I do think that families and schools are the first teachers. And I think that the study was correlational. So we noticed that there was a correlation between kids who lived in these spaces and who may have had access to Sesame Street, but it wasn't actually a study of individual children's experiences, and the findings were sort of on average, and so we don't know for sure which kids watched it and how much they watched it and if the effect was sort of similar across children. So I think that the show, the study points out a very interesting point that intuitively we all accept, which is that Sesame Street is amazing for children and that it is fantastic early childhood programming. But I think we need to be very cautious in interpreting those findings to mean that media can replace schools, or that what is happening on Sesame Street is comparable to what's happening in children's classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there needs to be far more work in many different kinds of studies before we can determine that. And so I would be very cautious of doing less preschool and doing more TV until we have much, much better data and research to support that.
Well, it's interesting that the study did indicate, which is saying a huge thing here, that the show had delivered lasting educational benefits, benefits as powerful, the study said, as the ones children get from going to preschool.
Yes, and I think that we have to be careful not to confuse correlation with causation. And we don't actually know, you know, perhaps children were watching Sesame Street in preschool classrooms, or perhaps the children who were watching Sesame Street were also the kids who were enrolled in preschool classrooms. And so what we might actually be finding is the preschool effect and not the Sesame Street effect at all, because this was a macro level study. We aren't certain what was actually driving the findings. Sesame Street might have actually been a proxy for some other types of family dynamics or community dynamics that were also at play. And so I think that the findings are really interesting, but I think I would need to see a different methodology and much more additional research before I would attribute sort of the types of claims that we're making specifically to the impact of Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm. What about the program? So much has been said about the good benefits of this program. One of the things that was found in the study, and it seems to me that this is a very important thing to learn in life, is that it helps foster empathy for others. And certainly the program has done that in terms of giving you an understanding of people who are homeless, who are incarcerated, people who are, you know, different than you are, to understand what it's like to walk in somebody else's shoes. The show has been exceptional in that regard. Has it been effective? Can a TV show do that, teach you empathy?
Absolutely. I think that the core skill, we know from, I'm a developmental psychologist, and one of the things that we know in my field is that perspective taking is sort of the root skill in building empathy. So the ability to understand how you're feeling and to understand how another person is feeling and to put those things together is sort of the root of empathy. And one of the things that Sesame Street has done so marvelously is expose children to characters who both look like them and who experience some of the things they experience, but it also exposes children to characters who may experience things that are radically different than their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, Sesame Street both helps kids see themselves. Many times kids who are navigating incarceration, trauma, poverty, things that are challenging to them, those things become sources of shame, or they become secrets. Or, you know, when we talk to children or we tell children stories, we tell them happy stories. And so if you're a child that has a difficult life, you begin to think that no one understands or that there aren't any stories that look like yours. And one of the most amazing things about Sesame Street is that all children can find themselves in it. And so they start to feel less alone. They start to feel like their story is more important. And when you start to feel more important yourself, you can actually begin to care more about other people's feelings. And so in that way, I think Sesame Street does help kids who might otherwise be marginalized or stigmatized feel like they matter. And because Sesame Street, which is valued by children, is telling stories that look like those children, kids that might otherwise bully or dismiss or not be aware that kids have those kinds of things happening in their life, suddenly begin to notice and pay attention. And I think that because of its willingness to courageously wade into the things that kids are facing in their lives, Sesame Street does help kids feel important, both because they may be experiencing it, but also because other children that they know may be experiencing those things as well.
You know, isn't that something that a television program gives us, that kind of valuable contribution? And we have a little example of that. We have a few clips from Sesame Street, because why not listen to some Sesame Street as we're talking about the show? Our guest was talking about incarceration and how many programs are there where children are dealing with, you know, incarceration, understanding it. They may have parents or people they know who are incarcerated. A lot of people are in this country. Here's how the Sesame Street explained to children about incarceration.
Hey, Alex, maybe we can get our dads to make cars like that with us.
Yeah! And then we can race cars together!
Oh, great idea!
I don't think so.
Oh, come on, it will be fun!
Yeah, just ask your daddy!
Well, he can't do it.
Well, why not?
He's not around right now.
Huh? Well, where is he?
Somewhere else.
Oh, did he go on vacation?
Is he visiting somewhere?
Yeah, where'd he go?
Yeah, where?
Look, I don't want to talk about it. Okay?
Okay, yeah. Did we say something wrong?
I don't know.
He's upset about something. Come on. Listen, Alex, whatever it is that's on your mind, you don't have to tell us. But we're your friends, and you can always talk to us if you want.
It's just all this talk about my dad and where he is got me really upset.
Oh, because your daddy's away?
And you miss him?
Yeah, but because of where he is, too. My dad's in jail.
In jail?
Why?
I don't like to talk about it. Most people don't understand.
Actually, I do understand what you're going through. When I was about your age, my dad was incarcerated, too.
He was?
Wait, what's carcerated? And why was your dad in it?
Incarcerated is when someone breaks the law, a grown-up rule, and then they have to go to jail or prison.
When you hear that, it's really remarkable that this television show is dealing with that very issue, isn't it? Just the fact that it does that, Professor Wright, is amazing.
It is. It's amazing. And no one does it better than Sesame Street. And I think that one of the most amazing things about Sesame Street is that as parents or as adults in kids' lives, we can watch it and learn to talk to kids about these things. In that clip, the character named the emotion. It, in two or three different places, the characters told the child how he might be feeling.
Mm-hmm.
They also talked about how they were feeling. And then they told the child that you're not alone in this. I understand. I'm here with you. And you're in charge of your story. You don't have to talk to us if you don't want to, but we're here because we care. And those are really the powerful messages that children need to hear no matter what they're dealing with. And Sesame Street is just masterful at surfacing those scary parts of children's lives and then giving them words to share them and also giving people around them words to comfort and hear them.
And it doesn't sound phony at all. You can hear, we were talking about the word empathy. You heard empathy in those voices.
Yes. Yes. Sesame Street is a place that cares. These are real characters. They are real people in children's lives. It blends fantasy and real, just like childhood. And I think that you heard the magic of Sesame Street in that clip. That wasn't sort of entertainment. That was
right.
Community. It was friendship. And it's just really special.
Mm-hmm. I know that you've done a lot of work, and you've spent the last 15 years actually working with young people who are homeless, preschool-age children who are homeless, and investigating the educational experiences of those people. That's pretty remarkable work. How do those young people, I mean, obviously they need a lot more than access to Sesame Street on a daily basis. What kinds of educational experiences are they receiving?
In terms of Sesame Street or more broadly?
Just in terms of more broadly, if you're moving all the time, if you're in one shelter or another, and How are you able to get those very things that we've been talking about, an understanding of who you are and that you're important and that somebody cares about you?
It's incredibly different. And one in 20 children in this country is homeless or has experienced homelessness.
One in 20?
One in 20 children. So it's a profoundly vulnerable population and a population that has grown, particularly given the economic crises of the last several years. And so as a country, I think we have to really begin to pay attention to these children. Young children are the largest population of homeless children, but typically most of the resources are spent focused on homeless adolescents, and we usually think about young children as being parts of families, and so we do sort of help families move around, and we try to provide support services to families, but children often have to just sort of move along because their supports are connected to the supports that we're providing to their parents. And we know that every time a child moves, educational setting, it takes approximately 6 months before them to be stable enough to learn again. And when children are constantly moving, they aren't able to build the types of relationships and stability that allows them to feel safe enough to learn. Many of the homeless children I work with are just too afraid to learn, frankly. And so I think we have to do a lot more to help them feel safe. But I think something like Sesame Street that they might be able to access regardless of which shelter they're in or where they might be, those familiar characters might actually be a source of support and continuity in their otherwise disjointed lives.
Familiarity is important during those years. It's always important, but it's really important when you're young.
Absolutely.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Travis Wright. He's Assistant Professor of Multicultural Education, Teacher Education, and Childhood Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He is a developmental psychologist, early childhood educator, and he also is a fan of Sesame Street and watched Sesame Street when he was growing up, as he said, in a wide open country when he was a child during the 1970s. We're looking at Sesame Street this hour and those aspects of the show that help develop empathy in young children and the take on so many difficult topics, which is quite something for a children's show. There's a study that was released in June that found that the show had lasting educational benefits to millions of American children, and some of those, they said that they might be as powerful as the ones children get from going to preschool. Our guests may say that goes a little bit too far, but what are the benefits of the show Sesame Street, and are there certain episodes that the show did that really touched you in some way, certain issues they took on that you said, oh my goodness, they did such a great job taking on such a tough, tough issue? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we have lines open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. How is it that this show has survived since 1969. That's really something, isn't it? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Sesame Street this hour of the program and the brilliance of that show and what it has done for many, many children since 1969. And we're going to move into a discussion of screen time that's being used to entertain children or maybe to manage children and the dangers there may be in having too much screen time. Can TV, at its best, really address the achievement gap in this country? Are there dangers in watching too much of it? How much of children's television is junk and how much of it is extremely worthwhile, as Sesame Street is? Our number is 800-486-8655. All of you who have watched the program, let us know what you think about that. And let's talk about TV more generally with you, because I know that you've looked at this issue as well, Dr. Wright. It is being used. So many young people spend so many hours in front of TV screens, being asked to just sort of go watch television for a while or to manage time or just as a way to be. And I would imagine that a lot of that is not nearly as worthwhile as Sesame Street is.
Absolutely. I think that Sesame Street is very special. As you heard in the earlier clip, it feels different. It feels like real life. It feels like children are engaged. Much media is designed to entertain children and to keep them contained. And when we are sort of asking kids to shut off their thinking and to shut off their emotions and to shut off their activities, learning or less learning is occurring. And so I think all TV isn't Sesame Street. And we need to be very careful about sort of the media diet that we're feeding our children.
And I'm wondering why it is that we are feeding them that, and does it have anything to do with this gap in standardized test scores that you remind us of between affluent and low-income students that has grown about 40%? If you're more affluent, are you more able to, you know, take various classes? And if you're not as affluent, you might have to spend more time watching television because you can't go do some of those other things because you don't have a way to get there.
Yes. So I think I would probably complicate the issue a little bit. The achievement gap is actually caused by a very complex system of inequality in our country and institutional racism and disparity in the ways that are that in the experiences that children are allowed to have in schools and the types of opportunities they're allowed to have sort of outside of school. And so I think that the achievement gap isn't just a deficit in content or a deficit in exposure. I think that there are systems that are sort of perpetuating the achievement gap in this country. And I think that people are desperate, well-intentioned people are desperate to find ways to level that achievement gap. I being one of those people, my entire career has been dedicated to figuring out how to help all children achieve at high levels. And so I think we're all looking for the silver bullet. And I think that it's going to be a lot of different strategies working together to help overcome the achievement gap. And media certainly has to be one of them. Children are engaged in media. They're engaged in more media all the time, more media than they've ever been engaged in. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, the achievement gap is higher than it has ever been, greater than it has ever been. And so I think that research demonstrates that media alone isn't necessarily the answer to the achievement gap. It might actually be one of the things that's perpetuating it. We know that children who watch more TV often perform less well in school. And so particularly when children are given access to lots of different kinds of media, the most vulnerable children are often watching the most media and watching media that in a way that is unsupervised. And so the types of things that they might be watching may be terrifying them. It may be inappropriate. It may be education, entertainment and not education. And so I think sort of unstructured access to media is particularly damning for kids who perform worst in these standardized measures of achievement. And so because of that, I think structured environments with caring adults who are skilled at building relationships to them, who can help them make sense of the scary parts of their life if they may be experiencing those things can't be provided by media. Those require real life, stable environments and stable adults who can help kids navigate. But I do think that media can be a powerful enhancement and that it can extend learning, and it also is a place that children who may be feeling safe, unsafe, and unstructured parts of their lives can retreat. So, you know, one of the things that a number of my children that I've worked with over the years have told me is that they look forward to watching TV because it helps them disappear. It helps them control their bodies. It gives them a place to be when scary things are happening around them. And so we know that media can be a powerful rabbit hole, a safety net for kids to climb into when they feel afraid. But we have to be really mindful about what kinds of things they're being exposed to there.
Well, is there enough to allow them to crawl into a place that makes them feel safe, or is there not very much of that?
All media is not Sesame Street.
Right. Ain't that the truth?
Yes. And, you know, one of the things I can say is that when I work with families in my clinical practice, many of them are very frank about sort of when they feel overwhelmed and they are at their wit's end and they don't really know what to do. They put the kids in front of the TV or they bring out the video games because they know that that is going to contain the child. And it in those moments, it really is about, I need the child to sit down and be quiet and to leave me alone for a second so I can get myself together. And sometimes that's really important. I'm glad that works because, you know, that's better than the alternative if families didn't have that outlet. But I think that that isn't the same as education, right? And we have to be really much more vigilant about the types of interactive experiences that we're creating for children through media exposure so that we can get some of these outcomes that Sesame Street creates.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea? There is something that's a lot of fun about Sesame Street, too. The characters that are created and the songs that are sung, it's very entertaining to watch, even if it has a great educational value. It's just entertaining. I think that you made the comment that learning has lost its fun for children. Does it need to be fun? And what do you mean it's lost its fun? How so?
We are so focused on children's outcomes that we are so afraid of who children in this country are becoming, and we view them as failing. Our failing children, our schools are failing, and we think that the issues associated with the achievement gap are just about what kids can't have or can't do or what they don't have. And so we are just inundating them with information and material and facts and tests.
Oh.
That because we're so afraid that they're failing, that we don't think they have time to play, they don't have time to learn. And schools, many schools are becoming joyless places where children spend their days regurgitating facts. Schools, adults in schools are assessed based on how well children are doing. And so kids, many children in this country don't walk into schools where they feel that people are excited to see them, that they are loved for who they are, that they can be anything they want to be, because the stakes have become so high for the adults in their lives that they, children matter because of how well they perform, and kids who aren't performing well matter less. And that's often how it feels in schools for children, particularly the children with whom I work. And so I think that one of the things that Sesame Street does really well that all of us who care about children can learn is that every kid matters. The lines between learning and fun and fantasy are blurred. Children learn through stories. Children learn through experiences. Children learn through relationships. And increasingly in schools, we're asking children to work independently. We're asking them to learn rotely. We're asking them to remember facts and not ideas. Most preschool classrooms in this country look like first or second grade. Not most. Many of the classrooms that I am in look like first or second grade classrooms instead of preschool classrooms, because we think that children don't have time to play. They don't have time to sort of enjoy being children because they're so far behind that we have to help them catch up. And the one major issue with that is that particularly for young children, they learn through play. They learn through experience.
Sure.
And so I think that our own good intentions are often the thing in the way of the outcome that we're hoping to achieve.
Mm. Well, for heaven's sake, if you don't have time to play when you're young, we don't take very much vacation time, and we work very hard when we get out of school. When are you going to have time? You always need time to have some fun and to be able to play, but you really need it when you're 4 years old, right?
Absolutely. One of the most important things that children should develop in childhood is a sense of their own bigness.
Mm.
They should feel like they can be anything they want to be, that the world loves them, that the world is just waiting for them to bring their gifts to it. And when you're a child that struggles, that may have things in your life that makes it hard to learn, or you show up at school sort of not at the same level as some of the other children, in an environment where you're valued for your outcomes, you begin to feel like you're smaller. You begin to feel like you can't be successful. You begin to wither away. And so the very kids who most need schools to help them feel a sense of their bigness are often the ones that feel the tiniest. And and so I think that's one of the deeper dynamics that is sort of underlying the achievement gap, because it's getting wider and not smaller. And I think, as we're increasingly making educational policy based on our fears for and of these children. And accidentally, I think we're creating environments that make those children feel smaller and less capable and less confident. And it's often our own good intentions that are the agents of that. And so I think we need to help schools become places where children are creative and fun and valued. And learning is something that unlocks doors, not something that makes you feel like you can't quite measure up. And that's something that Sesame Street has nailed for a long time. Kids just feel like they matter. They can turn on the show, the characters are going to be glad to see them, and they're going to learn something that helps them in their everyday life, and it isn't attached to an outcome or a test or an incentive chart or
right.
The good kids and the bad kid list in the classroom. And so That is one. That's an important part of the magic of Sesame Street.
Yeah, it sure is. We welcome phone calls if you would like to join our conversation. We'd love to hear from you. We're talking, the reason for the program was this study that was done at the University of Maryland in June that looked at the magic of Sesame Street and how much children can learn from Sesame Street, if they can learn as much as from preschool. But we're looking at the elements of Sesame Street that maybe it would be good if they were learned by schools in general, of how to make school fun and to make children be engaged as partners in learning, to make people feel, as our guest, Dr. Travis Wright, has said, that they can be anything they want to be in the world, and instead of having them to know things and learn things that might be beyond them developmentally and that might be boring or put them behind computer screens at really young ages, and instead of this lively, affirming kind of education. So maybe we can learn from Sesame Street as this conversation develops about how we should teach, what kinds of classrooms we should have. What do you think? Your comments about this program, if it is... What do you think when I ask you, why do you think it's lasted since 1969? What does it teach us about empathy and about learning and about acceptance and about the importance of each and every one of us? Are our schools missing that, particularly with kids who have, you know, difficult backgrounds? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Dr. Travis Wright. He is a childhood studies professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's doing a lot of very interesting and very, very important work. He's an educational researcher and early childhood educator, a psychologist, and he was a dedicated Sesame Street viewer during his own childhood. He has spent the last 15 years working with children who are growing up in urban poverty and is presently investigating the educational experiences of preschool-age children who are homeless. Let's go to phone calls for him. David in Onalaska. Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I've been watching I did watch Sesame Street when I was in kindergarten and almost five decades ago, and it was a great show and actually, you know, interesting. I think the focus should be just on really helping to educate parents to, you know, they're the ones that have to be in control of helping to educate their children, you know, by doing homework, being engaged, going to the school. That's where our society is really failing is with these parents that are not equipped to actually raise children. You know, we have to focus on you know, having families stay together and nurture, make sure that the parents can nurture the children. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dr. Wright.
Parents are children's first teachers, and I think we have to do everything we can to support parents and being the best teachers that they can be. And one of the great things about Sesame Street is that parents can watch it with their children. With the families with whom I work, I often encourage them to sit down and watch television, Sesame Street in particular, with their kids so that they can see how the adults on the show are talking to children and to notice how the children are responding. Kids don't come with instruction manuals, and particularly for parents who may not have had the best parenting themselves or the best educational experiences, it's difficult to know how to do it differently. And so resources like Sesame Street can be great parent education tools as well.
Christy in Beloit. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Well, I'm a teacher, and I have been for about 15 years, and I called in because of the comments that your guest was making about how, you know, we need to make classrooms fun, and it's, you know, really important to make learning fun for kids, and I could not agree more that is really important. In fact, in Denmark, the kids play. They don't start actually reading until I think they're 6 or 7. They just play because that's where they are developmentally. But as a teacher, you know, teachers have no problem making classrooms fun, but what's been happening is that educational policy is just making, is just sucking the air out of the classrooms. I mean, the days are scheduled, you know, minute by minute, and everyone's held accountable, you know, for almost to how many breaths a kid takes in the day, you know. And it, I think it just really needs to come down from not so much the teachers making classrooms fun, but it really needs to come down from state policy, you know, national policy on what actually is appropriate for, you know, the human mind and its development.
And it's all scheduled with what? With learning certain things, Christy? With taking tests?
Different subjects. You know, there's, you know, in elementary, one teacher is expected to provide, you know, instruction in reading and writing and math and science and social studies. I mean, and it's just the amount of instruction that's expected to fit into one day is more than the amount of time that, you know, is in one school day. So it's just, you know, teachers, you know, we lament the days where it, you know, where there were more big projects and where there were more, you know, projects that, you know, incorporated across curriculum, across subjects, and, you know, where you could have kids do big projects. But now it just seems like it's just down to the minute, you know, scheduled.
Dr. Wright.
Absolutely, Christy. I think that you are really helping us hear what it feels like to be a teacher in schools today, and my heart is with you. And I know that almost every teacher I speak with feels the same. Increasingly, educational policy is being made by people who are not educators. And I think because of the fears of the achievement gap and some of the other things we've talked about, increasingly, as a society, we're trying to make teaching teacher-proof. And so we're standardizing curriculum, and we're standardizing books, and we're standardizing the learning experience. The problem is that I've never met a child that was standard in my life. And so I think that we really need to take a step back and to value teaching and teachers, and to value what we know about education and what works best for kids. And we need to allow teachers to do what they know how to do and create more magic in the classroom. So thank you, Christy. I think you're absolutely right, and I couldn't agree more.
Well, how are we going to do all of that? How are we going to change things? Because we're going down a different direction.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we have to sit together and think about what we want, what the goal is. Do we want kids who are courageous, confident learners, or do we want kids who can do exactly what they're told, say back exactly what we want them to say, and who will just toe the line? And I think we educate from our values, and I think as a society we can't actually agree, or we don't yet agree on what schools should be doing. I mean, we have, you know, many people saying that schools should be creating these sort of courageous, critical thinkers, and we have other educational policies that are being designed to help kids sort of remember facts and to sort of become more repositories of knowledge. And so I think we have to begin when I work with teachers, I ask them to think about whether they are teaching from hope or they're teaching from fear.
Oh,
and the classroom looks very different when you are creating a world of hope versus creating a place of fear. In fear-based classrooms, there's much more control. Kids are expected to work much more independently. Knowledge is much more rote. We value kids much more for what they do instead of who they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that the policy climate in this country is being driven largely by fear. Mm-hmm. We are so afraid of our failing schools that we are creating schools of fear. And I think when you begin creating both policies from hope and you start creating classrooms from a place of hope, the educational endeavor looks incredibly indifferent. Parents become engaged as partners. They're not the problem. Teachers become participants in educating children, not just technicians or mechanics. And so I think that that we have to change our hearts and our minds first. And then I think that, you know, we have policies. We have 100 years of educational research that shows us what works. I think that we've lost our way a little bit, and the educational conversation has been largely wrestled away from parents and educators, and I think we need to really insert our voices much more in that conversation.
Mm. Interesting response. Nice vision for education. Christy, thank you so much for your call. Chris in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to have Channel 10 get some credit here. I was part of a program called Children's Fair, and we were on 11 years every day, twice a day, before Sesame Street. We were getting national awards, and when Sesame Street came down the pike, our young producer said, gosh, we can get this national program. We don't need Children's Fair anymore. But the program Children's Fair, many of the most important things that were started on Sesame Street came from Children's Fair. The drawing, the Brownie Bear and the drawing, the programs I taught them, Miss Chris, and art projects. They had Brownie Bear. They had exploring many kinds of activities. It was live for a couple of years. And when I was a story princess, I told stories that were 20 minutes or so, and the kids were right there. Made an error in one way. They shortened everything in commercial techniques of boom, boom, boom. And I found that after that, the children, I had to change the pace. I had to be sure that I kept their interest. But now they've come back to really recognizing that children have a longer interest span. And one of the greatest compliments I received that might reflect what Children's Fair was about, when the man who started Discovery World here in Milwaukee was giving a lecture, and at one point I came in late, and he sort of looked at me as if he knew me, and I thought, huh? Well, halfway through, he said, we want to do at Discovery World, we want to give the children of Milwaukee the same opportunity, the feeling that they could create whatever they wanted to do if they worked at it. And then he pointed to me and he said, we want to do what Miss Chris had us do when we were little kids. And I was watching her on television. And I say that not for self-glory, but I say that because Channel 10 and Children's Fair was the base of all of the really great things that Sesame has turned into.
Thank you very much, Chris. It must make you feel great to have been at the forefront of all of that. And there were, I remember some other shows. I grew up in the Chicago area. There were several shows that were directed toward children that had the same kind of elements that Chris was talking about in the Channel 10 show here. It seems as though TV used to do more of that. I think they were required to do more of that kind of programming, weren't they, Dr. Wright?
I'm not for sure, to be honest with you. I'm not a media specialist, so I'm not for sure, but I do appreciate all the work that people have done.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris, for the call. We wanted to play another clip from Sesame Street, and we'll do so, and we'll have our Dr. Wright analyze what he's hearing. This is these are so much fun to listen to. They're just terrific, demonstrating the importance of inclusion for their bilingual audience, proving that it doesn't matter if you count uno, dos, tres, or one, two, three from Sesame Street. Another example of how wonderful it is and why it's been around for so many years.
But it's nice and warm now.
Yes. Sí, está muy bonito.
I hope it stays like this. Sí, porque si se pone frío, I'm going to have to use my electric blanket.
Sí. Let's cool
it. I don't have to.
Not only are they talking, they're talking in two languages, Spanish and English, at the same time. Hey, hold it, guys. Do you know that you're talking in both English and Spanish together?
We were?
No me fijé.
I didn't even realize it.
Yeah, me neither.
You sure were. It's bad enough when you're yakking and annoying me in one language. Why do you have to do it in two languages?
Well, Oscar, we'll be happy to tell you.
Sometimes I say hola. Sometimes I say hello.
You do.
Sometimes I say vamos. And sometimes I say, let's go, in case you're wondering how this could be. It's 'cause there's both English and Spanish. Spanish words in me.
I understand now. I'm leaving.
They're such nice pieces, aren't they? I mean, I was listening to that thinking, if you did that a lot, you'd be knowing Spanish by the time you were four, right?
Absolutely. You would certainly have a good foundation. And I think when you start to disentangle all the messages that are embedded in that clip, you can see why Sesame Street is so magical. For one, we see that we hear different kinds of voices. We hear kids with different accents and different languages. And many times when you're the only child in a classroom that sounds like you, it's very easy for that to become stigmatized. But this reframed that, right? This said, I have two languages, not just one language, and that makes me really smart. And that's an important message for the kid who may be feeling stigmatized to hear, but it's also an important reframe for kids who may be bullying or stigmatizing. In that clip, I think it must have been Oscar the Grouch who was saying,
yes,
you drive me crazy in two languages. And kids are very self-focused. They use how they're feeling to decide if something is good or bad. And so when they hear things that might be uncomfortable to them, they often say, I feel uncomfortable, therefore that makes me uncomfortable and that must be bad. But this actually showed that child how to sort of, Oscar opened his mind up and see, wow, this could actually be a way that I could grow, or that's a really good thing, not just a bad thing because it makes me uncomfortable. So I think in that clip we hear sort of Oscar sort of opening up his mind, and then we hear the child who may be speaking two languages being valued, which is often not the case in schools. And then there's the learning occurring around that. Let me tell you these different words in two languages. So it's so layered and so rich, and I think that's what the best learning, whether it's on TV or in the classroom or in the car with parents, that's what the best learning does. It teaches you how to be a better person. It gives you more information. It opens up the world. It helps you think about yourself and the other person differently. And you don't even know what's happening. It just feels like magic.
Absolutely. You're having fun along the whole way, aren't you? And that's
absolutely
a good thing.
Yeah, it was a beautiful clip.
Let's go to Kurt in Nina next. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
All right, Kurt. How are you?
Not bad. Hopefully you can hear me okay. I'm driving, so I'm on speakerphone.
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay. Two things. One of the things I don't know if anybody pointed out was just the quality of the music on Sesame Street is amazing. The songs they come up with, the arrangements of other songs like Hip to Be a Square and so on, even as an adult, I find very entertaining. And my son, who's 20 now, grew up with those songs, and he's now a musician, I think, in large part because of those songs.
Hmm.
And then the second thing, I hope Miss Chris is still listening, because I am of the generation before Sesame Street, and Miss Chris, you were everything to us of that generation growing up in Milwaukee. I and my brother looked forward to that show just with a passion because of Miss Chris and the way that she taught and so on. So, Miss Chris, we love you, and I'm just so glad to hear that you're still around.
Oh, she's very active and taught for many, many years as well. Isn't it interesting that he credits Sesame Street for his son becoming a musician? Can that happen with a TV show, Dr. Wright?
Absolutely. I think that we so often underestimate how important young children and their experiences are. The seeds that we plant in childhood are the fundamental seeds that are planted. Those are the seeds that lay the foundation for who children are going to become. The interests that they develop there become the things that are interesting to them when they grow up. Early childhood is so important, and when children have opportunities to learn new skills and new knowledge and things that make them feel powerful and strong and that open up the world to them, they're going to pursue those things for the rest of their lives.
Hmm. Well, you're delightful. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Wright.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Travis Wright. He's an assistant professor of multicultural education, teacher education, childhood studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's a psychologist and watched Sesame Street and loved it during his own childhood in the 1970s. We should have him on talking more extensively about his last 15 years of work with children who are well, he's investigating their educational experience of preschool-age children who are homeless. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to K.P. Whaley for our on-air production today, and thanks for your calls and for listening. We'll be with you again mañana a las uno. Gracias.